The more cultured Indians, the deep-thinking men who feared for their country, turned aside from the religion of their ancestors and pondered deeply on the sorry state of man's soul. One such man was a Hindu Raja, an enormously rich warrior king. He worried and fretted about the future of his only son Gautama, who had so recently been born into a troubled world. The father and family had the strongest desire that Gautama should grow up as a warrior prince and later inherit his father's kingdom. An old soothsayer, called in to prophesy, had said that the young man would be a prophet of great renown. To the stricken father this was a fate worse than death. Around him he had many examples of young upper-class men renouncing a life of comfort and going forth as pilgrims, barefooted and clad in rags, to seek a new spiritual life. The father determined to do everything possible to thwart the prophecy of the soothsayer. He laid his plans. Gautama was an artistic, sensitive young man, with a keenly alert intellect which was able to sweep through subterfuge and penetrate to the heart of the matter. Autocratic both by birth and upbringing, he yet had consideration for those under him. His perceptions were such that he became aware that he was carefully guided, shielded, and permitted to meet only those who were personal servants or caste equals. At the time of the soothsayer's prophecy, the father had given the strictest orders that his son be at all times shielded from the evils and sorrows which trouble those beyond the palace confines. The boy was not to be permitted to go out alone, his travels were to be supervised, and he should be allowed to meet no one who had poverty or suffering. Luxury and only luxury was to be his lot. All that money could buy was his. All that was unpleasant was ruthlessly excluded. But life cannot continue thus. Gautama was a young man of spirit, and with more than his share of determination. One day, unknown to his parents, unknown to his tutors, he slipped from the palace and with a carefully chosen servant, went driving beyond the palace grounds. For the first time in his life he saw how other castes lived. Four incidents provoked the most profound thoughts, and thus changed the course of religious history. At the outset of his journey he saw an old man, trembling with age and illness, leaning heavily upon two sticks as he painfully dragged himself along. Toothless, blind with cataract, and senile, the old man turned a vacant face towards the young prince. For the first time in his life Gautama realized that old age came to everyone, that with increasing weight of years one was no longer active and supple. Badly shaken, the young prince continued his drive, full of strange and morbid thoughts. But there was another shock in store. As the horses slowed for a sharp turn, Gautama's horrified gaze chanced to alight upon a miserable figure sitting rocking and moaning by the side of the road. A man covered with suppurating sores, emaciated and disease-ridden, was groaning as he picked yellow scabs from his body. The young Gautama was shocked to the core. Sick at heart, perhaps physically sick too. He pondered the question as he was driven along. Must one suffer? Does suffering come to all? Is suffering inevitable? He looked at his servant who was driving. Why was he so calm? The young prince wondered. The driver was unconcerned, as if such sights were common. This, then, must be why his father had shielded him. On they drove, with Gautama too stunned to order otherwise. Fate, or destiny, had not finished, though. At an exclamation from Gautama, the horses were slowed, they came to a halt. At the side of the road was a naked corpse, grotesque and bloated by the fierce heat of the sun. A flick of the driver's whip, and a dense cloud of flies feeding upon the body, rose in a swarming mass. The body, discolored and odorous, was revealed completely to the young man's sight. As he looked, a fly wandered out of the dead mouth, buzzed, and settled again. For the first time in his life Gautama saw death, knew there was death at the end of life. The young man mutely ordered the driver to return. He sat thinking of the impermanence of life, sat thinking of the beauty of a body which yet had to fall into decay. Was beauty so temporary, he wondered? The wheels revolved, the dust rose in clouds behind. The young prince sat in thought, morose, and drawn. By chance, or fate, he looked up in time to see a well-clad, serene monk striding along the road. The monk, calm and tranquil, radiated an aura of inner peace, of well-being, of love for his fellow men. The brooding Gotama, shocked to the core of his being by the sights he had seen, now received another shock. Were peace, contentment, tranquility, all the virtues, to be found only if one withdrew from everyday life and became a religious? A monk? A member of some mystic order? Then he resolved would become as that monk. He would withdraw from the life of the palace, withdraw from the only life he knew. His father raged and stormed, his mother wept and pleaded. The servant was banished from the kingdom. Gotama sat alone in his room, thinking, thinking, thinking endlessly of the sights he had seen. Thinking that if he had seen so much in one short excursion, his only excursion, how much more suffering and misery there must be. He refused food, pined, moped, and just sat wondering what to do, how to escape from the palace, how to become a monk. His father tried in every way he knew to lift the load of sorrow and depression afflicting the young prince. The best musicians were ordered to play constantly that the young man should have no quiet in which to think. Jugglers, acrobats, entertainers of all types were tried. The kingdom was scoured for the most beautiful maidens, girls versed in the most exotic arts of love, that Gotama should be aroused by passion and thus lifted from his despondency. The musicians played until they dropped from exhaustion. The maidens danced and practiced erotic exercises until they, too, collapsed fainting from exhaustion. Then only did Gotama take notice. He stared with horror at the awkward postures of the fallen musicians. He looked with shock at the naked maidens, pale with the pallor of collapse, with the cosmetics standing out vivid and ugly now that the glow of health had vanished. Once again he pondered the impermanence of beauty, how transient it was, how quickly it fled. How sad, how ugly was life. How garish and tawdry were painted women when their immediate activity had ended. He resolved to leave, resolved to shun all that he had known, and seek tranquility wherever it might be found. His father ranted, doubled, and then trebled the palace guard. His mother screamed and became hysterical. His wife, poor woman, collapsed, and all the palace ladies wept in concert. Gotama's baby son, too young to know what was going on, yelled and shrieked in sympathy with the misery around. The palace advisers waved their hands helplessly, and poured out torrents of words to no avail. For days he worked at means whereby he could leave. The palace guards knew him well. The people in the kingdom knew him not at all, for he had so rarely left the palace confines. At last, when he was almost in despair, the thought occurred to him that he had only to disguise himself from his immediate guards. From some friendly servant, who was well rewarded and who immediately left the kingdom, Gotama obtained old and ragged clothes such as the mendicants wore. One night, at dusk, before the palace gates were locked, he donned the old clothes, and with his hair tousled, and his hands and face well covered with dirt, he shuffled out with beggars who were being turned out for the night. Into the forest he went, away from the main roads and people, fearing that his ignorance of the ways of everyday life would betray him. All the night he wandered, striving to reach the limits of his father's kingdom. He had no fear of the tigers and other wild animals prowling at night. His life had been so shielded that he did not know the danger. Back in the palace his escape had been discovered. The whole building was searched. The outbuildings, the parks. The king rushed around shouting orders, armed men stood at the alert. Then everyone went to bed to await the dawn when a search could be mounted. In the women's quarters there was wailing and lamentation at the fury of the king. Gotama crept through the forest, evading meetings where possible, being silent to all questions when it was not. From growing crops he took his food, living on grain, berries, and fruits, drinking from cold, clear springs. But the tale of the strange wanderer who did not behave as a wanderer should, eventually reached the palace. The king's men swept forth in strength, but could not catch the fugitive as he always hid in the thickets where horses could not go. At last the king decreed that all the dancing girls should be taken to the forest, and they should go in pursuit of Gautama and attempt to lure him back. For days they danced and weaved their way through the forest glades, always in sight of Gautama, always acting out their most seductive dances. At last, near the limits of his father's domain, Gautama stood forth and said that he was going into the world in search of spirituality, and would not return. His wife rushed towards him, the baby in her arms. Gautama heeded not her pleas, but turned away and continued his journey. The Indian teacher, having got thus far in a story which we knew as well as he, said, "From the then decadent Hindu religion a new belief was at that moment formed, a belief that would bring comfort and hope to many. For this morning we will end our session. This afternoon we will continue. Dismiss." The others rose to their feet, bowed respectfully to the teacher and left. I had trouble. I found that my robe had stuck to my leg scar with dried blood. The teacher left without giving me a glance. I sat in considerable pain and wondered what to do. Just then an old cleaning monk hobbled in and looked at me in surprise. "Oh," he said, "I saw the teacher leave and I came to clean. What is the trouble?" I told him, showed him how the great scar had burst open, how the blood had poured out, and how I had plugged the hole with my robe. The old man muttered "TSK, TSK," and hurried out as fast as he could with his own deformed legs. Soon he returned with the infirmarian. The pain was like raging fire. I felt that my flesh was being torn from the bones. "Ah, my son," said the infirmarian, "you are as one born to trouble as surely as the sparks fly upwards." He sighed, and muttered, "But why are some of these great teachers, who should know better, so harsh, so unfeeling?" "The," he said, as he fastened a herbal compress and helped me to my shaky feet. "There, now you will be all right. I will give you a new robe and destroy the other." "Ow, Reverend Master," I exclaimed in some fright, my knees trembling with the shock. "I cannot have a new robe or everyone will think I am a new boy just joined. I'd rather have this one." The old infirmarian laughed and laughed and then said, "Come on, my boy, come with me and we will together see what we can do about this weighty matter." Together we walked slowly down the corridor to where the infirmarian had his office. Inside, on tables, ledges, and shelves, there were containers of herbs, a few powdered minerals, and odd items which I could not then identify. Tibetans only sought medical aid in cases of extreme emergency. Not for us the first aid kits of the West. We managed as nature intended. A broken limb would be set, of course, and a very deep wound stitched. We used the long hairs from a horse's tail for stitching. When well boiled it was very suitable. For stitching the very deepest layers we used the long fibers from shredded bamboo. The bamboo was also used as a drainage tube when one had to drain pus from an internal wound. Clean, well-washed sphagnum moss made very useful sponge material, and was also used for compresses, with or without herbal ointments. The infirmarian took me into a side room which I had not noticed. From a pile of old and mended robes he drew forth one. It was clean, well mended, and was very sun-faded. My eyes lit up at the sight, for such a robe would show that I had been in the Lamasery a long, long time. The infirmarian motioned for me to take off my robe. I did so, and he examined me for other injuries. HMMN. Skinny, undersized. Should be bigger for your age. How old are you, boy? I told him. So? Oh, I thought you were 3 years older. HMMN. Quite a man, eh? Now try on this robe. I swelled out my chest and tried to stand straighter, to look bigger and taller, but my legs would not stretch. The robe was somewhat too big for me and I tried to conceal the fact. Ah, said the infirmarian. You will soon grow and fill it up. Keep it on. Goodbye. But now it was time to eat before the afternoon classes. I had already lost much time, so I shuffled down to the kitchen where I explained my plight. Eat, eat, boy, and get on with it, said the friendly, soot-streaked cook, helping me generously. The sunlight streamed through the window. I stood with my elbows on the frame, looking out as I ate. At times the temptation was too much, and I flipped a little tsampla over the edge of the bowl onto some poor, unsuspecting monk far below.
"More, boy?" said the cook monk in some astonishment.
"More? You must be hollow," or he winked slyly at me. "Are you basting the heads of the brothers?" I must have blushed or looked guilty, for he laughed uproariously and said, "Then let's mix a little soot with this lot." But fun could not last forever. My bowl was again empty. Below, an increasingly cross group of monks were wiping their black spattered pates and peering suspiciously about them. One even started up the path. Hastily I withdrew from the kitchen, and sauntered as nonchalantly as I could out of the kitchen and into the corridor. As I turned the corner a glowering monk appeared and hesitated as he saw me.
"Let me see your bowl," he growled.
Assuming my most innocent expression, I reached into my robe and produced the desired article and handed it over for inspection.
"Is something wrong, sir?" I asked.
"That really is my bowl," I continued. The monk examined the bowl carefully, looking for traces of the soot which I had so thoroughly removed. He stared at me with the deepest suspicion, then, as he handed the bowl back, said,
"Oh, you are the injured one. You could not have climbed the roof. Someone is dropping wet soot on us.
He is on the roof, I will catch him." With that, he turned and dashed away towards the roof. I breathed deeply and sauntered on. Behind me there was a chuckle, and the cook monk's voice said,
"Well done, boy, you should be an actor. I won't give you away or I might be the next victim."
He hurried past me, off on some mysterious mission connected with food supplies, and I continued on my reluctant way back to the classroom. I was the first one there, and I stood braced in the window looking out. It always fascinated me to look out across the country from this eminence. The sight of the beggars at the Pargoatling, or Western Gate, and the never-failing thrill of seeing the eternal spume of snow blowing from the highest peaks of the Himalayas, I could spend hours, days, watching. Around the district of Lhasa the mountains formed a great U, the mighty Himalayas which formed the backbone of the continent. Having time on my hands I looked well, making a game of it. Below me the white lime-washed walls of the Potala melted imperceptibly into the living rock of what had once, eons ago, been a volcano. The lime-white of the man-made structure flowed into the grey and brown of the mountain, and where the one ended and the other began no man could now say. They had fused together so successfully. The lower slopes of the mountain were covered by the small bushes through which we boys often crawled when trying to escape detection. Lower still were the buildings forming the village of Sho, with the great courts of justice, the government offices, the government printing works, the civil records offices, and the prison. It was a busy scene. Pilgrims were progressing along the pilgrim's way hoping to acquire virtue by stretching their length on the ground, crawling forward a few feet, and then again lying prone. It certainly looked most amusing from my height above. Monks were striding about energetically between the houses, must be the proctors after a malefactor, I thought, and lamas were proceeding about their stately business on horseback. An abbot and his retinue turned into our road and slowly rode up the wide, stepped path towards the main entrance. A group of fortune tellers plied a brisk trade as they extolled the virtues day of their horoscopes blessed by a lord abbot, mind you, sure to bring you luck. The green of the willows in the marsh across the road attracted me, the fronds were gently swaying in the breeze. Pools of water reflected the racing clouds and changed color according to the color of the passing pedestrians. One fortune teller was established on the brink of a large pool, and he was pretending to read the future of his clients in the sacred water at the foot of the Potala. Trade was brisk indeed. The Pargoatling was thronged. Small stalls had been erected and itinerant traders were doing a sharp business selling foods and sweet stuffs to the pilgrims. A profusion of amulets and charm boxes were draped over the end of one stall, the turquoise and gold ornaments flashing brightly in the sunlight. Gaily turbaned Indians, heavily bearded, and with flashing eyes, strode around looking for bargains and trying to beat down the seller. Opposite towered Chakpori, Iron Mountain, slightly higher than the Potala but not so ornate,
Not so many buildings. Chakporai was austere, somewhat grey and grim. But Chakporai was the home of healing, while the Potala was the home of the god. Beyond the Chakporai the happy river sparkled and chuckled as it made its swift way down to the Bay of Bengal. By shading my eyes and straining a little, I could see the boatman paddling passengers across the river. His inflated yak hide boat always fascinated me, and I was beginning to wonder if I would not be better as a boatman than as a small acolyte in a large lamasery. There's no chance to be a boatman yet. As I well knew, I had to get on with my studies first. And whoever heard of a monk becoming a boatman? Far off to the left, the golden roof of the Jokhang, or Cathedral of Lhasa, dazzled the eyes as it reflected the sun's rays. I watched the happy river as it wandered through the marshy land, twinkling through the willow groves, and with a small tributary flowing under the beautiful turquoise bridge. Far off I saw a gleaming silver thread diminishing in the distance as the river followed its path towards the flat lowlands. This was a busy day. By leaning out of the window, with some danger of falling a long, long way, I could see more traders coming along the road from Drepung, coming from the high mountain passes. But it would be some considerable time before they were close enough for me to see details. Classes would start before that. The sides of the mountains were dotted with lamasaries, large ones that were self-contained towns, and small ones which clung precariously to the side of the steep rock pinnacles. Some of the very smallest ones, and the most dangerously positioned, were the hermitages of monks who had renounced the world and were walled into their small cells, there to spend the rest of their life. Was it really good, I wondered, to be so completely cut off? Did it help anyone when a young, healthy man decided to be walled up in a small cell, there to spend perhaps 40 years in total darkness, total silence, while he meditated upon life and tried to break free from the bonds of the flesh? It must be strange, I thought, to never see again, never speak again, never walk again, and to have food only every other day. Chapter 3. I thought of my guide, the Lama Miniadon Up, who had had to go to distant Parai very suddenly. I thought of all the questions which were welling up in me and which only he could answer. Never mind, tomorrow he would return, and then I should be glad to get back to Chakporai. Here, at the Potala, there was too much ceremony, too much red tape. Yes. I had a lot of questions which were bothering me and I could hardly wait for an answer. A swelling noise had been for some moments obtruding on my consciousness. Now the volume of sound reminded me of a herd of yaks in full charge. Into the classroom erupted all the boys. Yes, they were playing at being a herd of yaks. I sidled carefully to the back of the room and sat down close to the wall, out of the way of those who raced around. Round and round they went, leapfrogging one after the other, robes flying, voices raised in shrieks of joy. Suddenly there was a loud whump, and a gasp of violently expelled air. Dead silence fell upon the room, with boys frozen into position like carved figures in the temple. My horrified gaze saw the Indian teacher sitting on the floor, his eyes crossed and unfocused with the shock. Now his bowl and barley had been spilled from his robe, I thought with some glee. Slowly he stirred and climbed shakily to his feet, clutching the wall and looking about him. I was the only one sitting. I obviously had had no part in it. Oh! The wonderful, strange feeling to have a perfectly clear conscience. I swelled with virtue as I sat there. On the ground, half stunned, or petrified with fright, lay the boy who had dived straight at the spare midriff of the Indian teacher. The boy's nose was bleeding, but the Indian touched him with an ungentle foot and bellowed, "Get up!" Bending, he grabbed the boy by the ears and pulled him up. "Disgraceful, horrid little Tibetan scum," he bawled, slapping the boy's ears in time to his words. "I will teach you how to behave to an Indian gentleman. I will teach you yoga that will mortify the flesh so that the spirit may be freed." I must ask my guide, I thought, to tell me why some of these great teachers from other lands are so savage. The scowling teacher stopped knocking the boy about and said, "We will have an extended lesson period to teach you that you should be learning instead of being ill-mannered. Now we will start." I called out, "Oh!" But honorable master, I was doing nothing at all. It is not fair that I should have to stay. The Indian turned a ferocious face in my direction, and said, you would be the worst of the lot. Just because you are crippled and useless, it does not mean that you should escape the retribution of your thoughts. You will stay, as will the others. He picked up his scattered papers, and I was sorry to see that the beautiful leather bag with the handle across the top and the shiny button which opened it, had been scuffed by contact with our rough stone floor. The Indian noticed it, and growled, "Someone will pay very dearly for this. I shall claim another from the Potala." He opened his case and rifled through his papers, sorting them out. At last satisfied, he said, "We ended this morning with Gautama stating that he renounced his life at the palace, stating that he would continue his life searching for truth. Now let us continue." When Gautama had left the palace of his father, the king, his mind was in turmoil. He had undergone a most shatteringly sudden experience of seeing illness when he had not known of illness, of seeing death when he had not known of death, and of seeing peace profound, utter tranquility, and contentment. His thoughts were that as the wearer of the contented look was also wearing a monk's robe, then contentment and inner peace would be found in the garb of a monk, and thus it was that he set forth on his search for inner tranquility, in his search for the meaning of life. He wandered on and on into realms beyond those over which his father ruled, on and on following rumors of learned monks and erudite hermits. He studied with the best teachers that he could find, studying whenever there was anything to be learned. As he learned from one teacher all that the teacher could teach him, he moved on, ever in search of knowledge, ever in search of the most elusive thing on earth, peace of mind, tranquility. Gautama was a very apartment pupil. He had been favored of life, he had been given an alert brain and a bright awareness. He was able to pick up information and sort it in his mind, rejecting that which was useless to him and retaining only matter which was of benefit and worth. One of the great teachers, impressed by Gautama's readiness and acute intelligence, asked him that he should stay and teach, asked him to become a full partner in imparting knowledge to other students. But this was quite alien to Gautama's belief, for, he reasoned, how could he teach that which he did not fully understand? How could he teach others when he was still searching for truth himself? He knew the scriptures and the commentaries of the scriptures, but, while the scriptures gave a certain degree of peace, yet there were always questions and problems which broke the tranquility which he was trying to gain. And thus Gautama wandered on. He was as a man obsessed, a man with a burning drive which permitted him no rest, spurring him on and on in search of knowledge, in search of truth. One hermit led him to believe that only the ascetic life could lead him to tranquility, so, a rather impetuous man, Gautama tried the life of the ascetic. Long ago he had shed all material things, he had no material pleasures, he lived only to search for the meaning behind life. But now he forced himself to eat less and less, and, as the old stories say, at last he managed to live on one grain of rice a day. He spent the whole of his time in the deepest of meditation, remaining immobile beneath the shade of a banyan tree. But at last his sparse diet betrayed him, he collapsed through hunger, malnutrition, and lack of elementary care. For long he lingered at the point of death, but no enlightenment reached him. He still had not found the secret of tranquility, he still had not found the meaning behind the most elusive thing on earth, peace of mind, tranquility. Certain friends had gathered about him during the days of his starvation, thinking that here was a sensation, a monk who could live on one grain of rice a day. Thinking that they would gain great advantages by being associated with such a sensational man. But, like friends the world over, these deserted him in the hour of his need. As Gautama lay near the point of death through starvation, his friends one by one left him, wandered off in search of sensation elsewhere. Gautama was now alone again, free from the distraction of friends, free from followers, free to start pondering all over again on the meaning behind life. This episode was the turning point in the career of Gautama. For years he had been practicing yoga that he might, by mortifying the flesh, free the spirit from the bonds of the body, but now he found yoga useless to him, Yoga was merely a means of gaining a little discipline over a recalcitrant body, and had no great merit in assisting one to spirituality. He also found that it was useless to leave.